ensuring that people know about the Holocaust. A recent survey of young people in America revealed that most don't know many of the basic facts about the Holocaust. Two-thirds did not know that 6 million Jews were killed, and almost a quarter responded that the Holocaust was a myth or might have been exaggerated. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today, on the 82nd anniversary of Kristallnacht, we learn how local organizations and teachers are trying to change that. We'll discuss why there's such Holocaust ignorance among the American population and what its implications might be in terms of understanding the lessons of history. And we'll hear from survivor Edith Lucas Pagelson of Falmouth. She'll share her miraculous story and what she hopes people learn from it. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm your host, Jennifer Rooks. Today we are talking about Holocaust education and what lessons this period in history can teach us. My guests are Shenna Bellows, who is Executive Director of the Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine, and Abraham Peck, who is Adjunct Professor of History at the University of Southern Maine. He is a child of Holocaust survivors, and he founded the University of Maine's Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights Studies program. We invite your comments and questions. Send an email, a brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you both for joining us today. And Abe, the reason we're doing this program today, as opposed to another day, is that this marks a significant date in history. Can you explain what happened on November 9th, 1938 in Germany?
Well, thank you, Jennifer. Yes, it is an important date. The term that's used to describe the events of November 9th and 10th primarily is in German, Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass. We don't know where that term came from and who really invented it. But what I can tell you is that it was much more than just this idea of store and shop windows being broken. It was a systematic effort on the part of the Nazi government, and I'm afraid to say, with the participation of a large number of average citizens, even young kids who were let out of school to join in the destruction and sort of hassling of Jews throughout Germany. It was an effort to finally say to the Jews of Germany, this is it. Either you go now or there will be further worse consequences. As a result, it developed really into a pogrom. You know, this is the word we've used over the years to describe a spontaneous reaction, but one that was actually guided by a government, and usually against Jewish communities in Eastern Europe and in Central Europe. It has a background, of course, this event. It didn't happen spontaneously as the Nazis wanted it to be understood as. It really began a month earlier with a deportation of several thousand Jews who were Polish citizens but who had come to Germany after World War I to escape, in fact, pogroms in Eastern Europe. And the Nazis decided that, well, you know, if we're going to get the German Jews, the ones who were born in Germany and had been there as citizens for a very long time, if we're going to get rid of them, we ought to start with these people who have Polish passports, who are not German citizens. We're going to send them back to get their passports either stamped to be renewed or to be taken by the Polish government and, you know, never sent back to Germany. Well, several thousand of them, probably around 17,000, were put on trains and sent to Poland in October. The problem was that the Poles, who were themselves taking an action against the Jews to try to get them out, an economic boycott to get Jews to leave Poland, said to the German authorities, we don't want these people. We're not going to take them back. We don't even want them to come into Polish territory. So these several thousand Jews were essentially put into a no man's land. One of those families was the Greenspan family, who had been in Germany ever since World War One, who were Polish Jews, a father, a mother, a sister, an older sister, and a younger boy named Herschel, who was 17 at the time, but who was no longer in Germany, but had been sent by his parents to an uncle in Paris, so that he could at least have a decent education, because Jews were no longer allowed in the German educational system, only in so-called specialized Jewish schools. The parents, the sister actually, wrote a letter to Herschel in the weeks after they were deported and sitting in this no-man's land with little food and no facilities really for medicine, telling him how terrible things were. Well, he was a 17-year-old impressionable kid. He became angry and decided in his own mind that he would become the voice of revenge for those Jews who were stuck in this no-man's land. He was able to buy a pistol and went to the German embassy in Paris, demanding to see the German ambassador to France. Well, no 17-year-old kid with no credentials or background is going to be allowed that. So they sent down a young third secretary of the German embassy, a man named Ernst von Rath, who essentially was actually an anti-Nazi, but still working, you know, in the diplomatic corps. Greenspan opened fire on him, wounding him grievously. He lingered for a couple of days. Now, as soon as he was shot and the reports came to Germany, there were already outbursts against Jews in various cities. So the 9th and 10th were really the culmination, but these things started much earlier. Okay? Mm. And as a result, he lingered until the 9th of November. 9th of November was an interesting date in German history, especially for the Nazi regime, because it marked the failed attempt of Hitler and his followers to overthrow the Munich Bavarian government and then ultimately the Weimar German government in 1923. And there were a number of Nazis who were shot and killed. And so there was a beer hall commemoration, if you will. Well, at that time, then, Hitler was informed that von Rath had died. And essentially, then, all the plans that had been made previously for some kind of an event like this that the Nazis had already been planning were put into action.
Mm.
And throughout Germany, homes were ransacked, Jewish homes, Jewish businesses were set on fire, synagogues were set on fire, and then Jewish men and boys began to be arrested and sent to notorious concentration camps that would later be part of the Holocaust in places like Buchenwald, Dachau, Sachsenhausen. These are names, obviously, that we know from the Holocaust, but they were already in existence. And so, you know, that was the Nazis' effort. The consequences, of course, were that the world was outraged. Even our President Roosevelt issued a strong condemnation. But in the end, the reality was that no one did anything. No country said, this is terrible, we're going to take the Jews and bring them out of there, out of this hellhole, to our countries. For Nazis and for Adolf Hitler, it was a very, very good sign. It meant that they could continue to push forward with their immediate goal, which was to get rid of all the Jews in Germany, Greater Germany, because Austria had already been annexed, as well as Czechoslovakia, and to obviously gain possession of all the goods and services and stores and everything else that had been part of Jewish ownership. And ultimately, of course, it was the first step, I would argue, in the beginning of the Holocaust.
And Shanna, I want to bring you into the conversation. Abe made the point that no other country did anything at that point. And this whole program really is about the lessons of history. That is one of the major lessons, isn't it?
It's such a lesson. And it's why, you know, we at the Holocaust and Human Rights Center were founded in 1985 by Holocaust survivors who came to Maine after World War II and their allies with a mission of promoting universal respect for human rights through outreach and education. And many of those survivors who came to Maine wrote memoirs. And, you know, when you read about the events of Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass, in the first person, from in the words of people who experienced that, it makes you realize that that was a moment in history when countries like the United States, we could have intervened. We could have perhaps changed the course of history. And so we teach a workshop called Decision Making in Times of Injustice, where we walk students through different points in the 1930s when collective and individual decisions were made that led to the events of the Holocaust and the murder of 6 million Jews. But in today's history, it's that standing up against hatred, standing up against violence and bias is so important.
Shenna, one of the reasons we're doing this program today is because just a couple months ago, a new report came out surveying, I believe it was 1,000 young adults across America, and the results are really startling at how few not only understood the basic facts of the Holocaust, but how many thought it really didn't happen. Did that report surprise you?
It was shocking and alarming. So the survey demonstrated that 63% of millennials and Gen Z young people surveyed did not know the key facts of the Holocaust. They had not necessarily heard about the Holocaust, could not name at least one concentration camp, death camp, or ghetto among the 40,000 camps and ghettos that existed, and did not know that 6 million Jews were killed, murdered in the Holocaust. And so I think what that points to is the importance of Holocaust education, and just so thankful that you're doing this program today, because that's such important history. It's something that we cannot get lost. And unfortunately, as Holocaust survivors pass on, as that generation, you know, is no longer with us, we no longer have as many of those first-person accounts, and we have an obligation and a responsibility to keep that history alive and to share it with a goal of never again.
Abe, your parents were Holocaust survivors. Tell me their story.
Well, it's a very
a brief
story.
Version.
Yeah, well, I'm never brief, unfortunately, as you know, Shanna and Jennifer. But, you know, my parents were survivors, and unfortunately the only survivors of large families. In other words, they lost a combined total of 12 brothers and sisters and their extended families who were murdered in the camps. But, you know, the one thing that struck me even growing up, because my father was somebody who was obsessed with talking about what had happened to him. Many survivors didn't want to talk about it, especially to their children, because they didn't want to hurt their children as they were growing up with these terrible tales. My father found me, to a degree, a willing witness, even though I was very young. And what he would tell me especially is the time that he was interred in Buchenwald, the famous camp where Elie Wiesel was liberated several months after my father arrived there in August of 1944. And what my father told me that was so interesting and it stayed with me is that when he got there, you know, he was wearing a yellow star because the Nazis obviously put the yellow star on all of their Jewish people who were under their control. But then he began to see people wearing patches that were pink, that were purple, that were green, that were black. And he couldn't understand, who are these people? Aren't they Jews? Like, because that's all I see that have been rounded up and are dying and being murdered around me. But they were, in fact, you know, gay men. They were, in fact, Jehovah's Witnesses. They were, in fact, Scythian Roma, so-called gypsies. You know, and what it said to me was that the Nazis were really waging two wars. One was against, obviously, European Jewry and its destruction, but also a battle against human values. And it started really with the murder of physically and mentally challenged young boys and girls, Germans for the most part, German Christians, who they began to murder in 1938, 1939, because, again, they were a threat. you know, to the racial purity and development of the so-called Aryan race that the Nazis imagined themselves to be the leaders of. But my parents were married in the Lodz ghetto, Lodz Poland ghetto, in September of 1943. They had known each other very briefly. My father owned a bakery in the city of Lodz Poland. And one time in 1936 or 37, they didn't remember, my mother walked in, they were both living in the city, to buy a challah, the ceremonial bread for the Jewish Sabbath. And so he remembered her, and he thought she was kind of cute. They didn't meet again until 1943, when they were living close by in the Jewish ghetto that had been created by the Nazis in 1940, and putting in thousands of Jews in terrible, terrible conditions. They met again, and, you know, it became a relationship that ended with them being married. My father was taken away 6 months later to various Nazi labor camps. My mother stayed on till the Lodz ghetto was liquidated in July and August of 1944, and then sent to Auschwitz, but in a way that was not the normal procedure. Some of you may have seen and heard of the movie Schindler's List, where this Nazi industrialist saved 1,100 Jews because he took them from a ghetto and brought them to a factory that he owned in Germany. Well, the administrator of the Lodz ghetto, a German named Hans Biebhoff, who basically was in charge of taking the possession of things that the Jews had, all of their possessions, and using them as slave labor, decided when the ghetto was being liquidated by the Nazis that he might be sent to the Russian front, which wasn't a cool thing to go to because it was obviously a very, very bad situation for the Nazis in Russia, in the Soviet Union. So he took... he and a couple of his administrators went to the city
That's okay.
Dresden, you know, which is in Germany, opened up a factory and took about 150, 200 men and women who were still there, Jews, and took them to Auschwitz and then had them simply stay there for a couple of weeks and brought them to Dresden to work in his factory. My mother was among those people. And so both my father and my mother were separated from March of 1944 until May of 1945. My mother lived through the carpet bombing by British Air Force, and American Air Force in the bombing of Dresden in February of 1945. She was able, under the bombing, to ultimately, with two other women, get out of there, escape, and go over into the Czechoslovakian border, where, in fact, in April of 45, she was liberated by American troops, the only American troops in that part of Czechoslovakia. All the others were Russian troops that were coming in to take over. My father was sent from Buchenwald to another labor camp and then forcibly taken to a camp called Theresienstadt, which had been a model camp, so-called, for mostly German and Czech Jews. That the Nazis had wanted to create a showplace so that the people who were coming to look at the camps, the Red Cross, would think that it was really being run very well. People were happy. So they created, you know, singing groups, outdoor cafes to fool the Red Cross officials, who came back and said, well, you know, they're running very, very nice places. People seem to be reasonably happy, even though they're interred there. Well, my father was marched there at a time when that was no longer the case. People were dying left and right. And he arrived there in April of 1945. And then a couple of weeks later, the Soviet troops, the Russian troops, came in and liberated it. Well, my mother, in the meantime, had gone to Prague in Czechoslovakia because it was a central place where survivors came to look and see if anybody had survived. Do you know this person? Do you know that person? Do you know my husband? My mother ran around asking those questions, putting signs on a wall, ran into a man who had just left Theresienstadt, who in fact had been a friend of my father's in the Polish city of Lodz, and said, yes, I just left your husband. Now, this is between March of 44 and May of 45. Neither of them knew whether the other person had survived. He said to her, this friend of my father's, I'll take you to see your husband. She got there, and just as she was about to enter it, she learned that a typhus epidemic had broken out in the camp, and it was quarantined. You couldn't get in. She had to wait 3 weeks before she could enter the camp. When she did, my father was sitting at a table with two Russian doctors and an American rabbi, a chaplain, who had been sent to be with the survivors. My mother walked in, and her friend, my father's friend, walked in and said to my father, your wife is here. In walked this woman who weighed probably 80 pounds, whose hair was totally cut off, shorn by the Nazis, bald almost, had a huge swelling on her head from a Nazi guard, a woman guard, that had hit her with a frying pan when she found her trying to take some food from the kitchen in the camp. My father looked at her, and he had no idea who she was. So they had to play a 20 questions game, where my father was asking her questions about their past, about their marriage, until he finally realized, yes, this is my wife.
Abe, it's a remarkable story. We have to go to a break, though. Okay. We had to go to a break a few minutes ago. So we'll be right back. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bangor Savings Bank, celebrating all the ways people all over Maine are making life a little better. Bangor.com/spreadkindness. And Eastern Basements, a division of Maine-owned Eastern Mold Remediation, offering basement waterproofing solutions. EasternBasements.com.
The Supreme Court is hearing arguments on the Affordable Care Act.
I'm as confident as ever that when we look back 5 years from now, or 10 years from now, or 20 years from now, we'll be better off because we had the courage to pass this law.
We'll look at the history of the ACA and what's at stake now, plus the latest on the election, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up this afternoon between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. For those of you counting on public radio, anywhere, any place, the Maine Public app is your solution. Stream Maine Public Radio or Classical, or just catch up on the news. The Maine Public app is available for both Apple and Android smartphones and tablets, and it also gives you access to many PBS and Maine Public Television programs. You can easily find the Maine Public app in both the Apple App Store and in the Google Play Store, and it's free.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're talking about what happened during the Holocaust and lessons learned from that history. My guest, Abraham Peck, who is adjunct professor of history at USM. His parents survived the Holocaust. And State Senator Shenna Bellows, who is executive director of the Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine. Share your comments and questions via email. That's talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Joining us on the line now, Edith Lucas Pagelson, a Holocaust survivor, and she wrote the book Against All Odds, A Miracle of Holocaust Survival. She lives in Falmouth. Thank you so much for joining us, Edith.
Hello, I'm right here. I heard my name.
Hi, Edith, and I just finished your book this weekend. Thank you so much for writing it. What a remarkable story of survival, and I do see why you put the word miracle in your subtitle. We started this program talking about Kristallnacht. Tell us what you remember of that night.
That was my first experience of horror. I was at that time 12 years old, and my father came home from synagogue because he had to take to pay to my parents. My grandparents were dead. He came home and said, "You don't have to go to school today. They burned the synagogue." And I went at the time for elementary school and could not go to school anymore after that. And then he came back and they had really burned it again, and they had to do it again.
Edith, I read in your book that your family had a hardware store that was completely trashed, that you and your sister and your mother survived, or you and your mother, your sister had been sent away from by then, hid in the attic that night.
Correct.
But that was just the first miracle of survival, and you actually you realized later that after being taken to Birkenau, you were meant to be gassed.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, anyway, we had the gas part. My father was arrested.
The gas chamber.
And they took him to Buchenwald. And here's my mother and my sister. And they had already damaged our store, our apartment, and we were hiding in that attic. We were sent I was in Auschwitz, yes. That was later. I was also first in Terezin, and then they sent us to Auschwitz. And he said, "Oh, we have to go to a shower." So we had to all strip our clothes. We went into a stone house, regular house, and then we sat in tears, and the shower heads were up there. No shower came out. We waited and we waited, and the gas chamber was malfunctioning, and this was one of the other miracles. We had to go out, and we got in other blocks in Auschwitz, and that was it.
Mm.
And then we went to other camps. So,
Edith, many people see that, and I want to encourage everybody in our audience to read Edith's book, because there's no way to tell we do not have time to tell all of the remarkable stories in that. But I want to talk to you about your liberation, because I think so many people have seen these stories, these old newsreels of Americans or Soviets going into the camps and liberating people. It was not like that for you, correct?
No, it wasn't. When we came back to Germany, we had an aunt in Brooklyn, in New York, and my sister, as you know, was one of the children who took England. To England, thousands of children. And when we came here to America, we had not a penny. And we went on the marine perch over the ocean, and there was my sister, and we didn't see her for 8 years. And we met my aunt.
Mm.
And I wanted to talk about it. They said, "Oh, forget about it. You have a new life now. But you can never forget this misery that we went through."
Edith, I know that you have spent a lot of time talking to school groups and any other group that will invite you. What is the message you want them to hear and take with them and remember for the rest of their lives?
They are wonderful children, number one. They are about the middle school and high school, and what they were about the age of that I was when it happened. I tell them, hate is the worst thing you can have. You have to be optimistic. If you have were negative, it's much harder. And I have always positive thinking, and even now, everything will be okay, and it will be. And I had more miracles, and I said, this will be another miracle for me.
Well, Edith, thank you so much for joining us on Maine Calling today. Edith Lucas Pagelson's book is Against All Odds, A Miracle of Holocaust Survival. It is a remarkable book. Thank you so much for writing it and joining us today. We're going to move on to Heidi Omlor, who's at Ellsworth High School. Heidi, you're a social studies teacher. Thank you so much for joining us. Heidi, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Well, yes, now I can hear you.
Okay,
go ahead,
so
Heidi.
Sorry. Thank you.
You teach social studies at Ellsworth High School. I'm sure you saw this report about how many young people don't know very much about the Holocaust. Tell us how the education, Holocaust education, is in Maine. When the kids hit social studies in high school, have they learned about it already? Are you the first time in which it's part of the curriculum?
I'm not the first time. I would add that I teach Holocaust and Genocide Studies as a standalone elective. And so I probably have anywhere between 16 and 20 kids each year take that class. And it's really varied, to be honest with you, Jennifer, on what their background with the Holocaust is when they come in. One of the very first things I do on day one is to just, you know, have them tell me a little bit about what do they know. Usually in the eighth grade, it seems like, at least in Ellsworth, they seem to do a pretty good job with at least having some survivor testimony read and a few other things. But a couple of years ago, actually, at the high school, in my Holocaust class, my students took it upon themselves, actually, to find out what the rest of the student body knew. And we put a survey together, and to be honest with you, we were all really quite shocked. It was very, very similar to this latest survey that you're referring to that Shanna has already spoken about. And it really, the knowledge is really lacking. What I've found as a social studies teacher is that we have a limited amount of time, and that's the reality of it. And the Holocaust usually is mentioned, but the amount of time really to cover it in any depth is just not there. So 2 years ago, with my Holocaust and Genocide Studies students, we actually proposed a bill to the Maine legislature to make Holocaust education in our state mandatory. Louis Lucchini is the senator that has been working with us. Unfortunately, that bill died last spring when the legislature closed down, and we're hopeful when it reopens in a new session that the bill will be brought back to life. My students are still very excited about it. They really see a need for this education.
Well, let me ask you that, Heidi. I'm going to ask a question that many of our audience members will say there's an obvious answer, but apparently not everybody is going to have an answer to this. Why? Why is it so important that this be mandatory, in your view, in Maine schools?
It's a great question. And actually, I've had a lot of people ask me that question. I mean, there's the historical aspect of it, which is important, obviously. There's the personal aspect of it. I teach the Holocaust through testimony. But the larger picture, or the bigger picture, as I call it with my students, is really the life lessons that come out of the Holocaust as an event. I use a tool called the Pyramid of Hate, and it's five layers. At the very top of the pyramid is the worst case scenario, is genocide, is the Holocaust. All the layers that lead up to that, especially the first two tiers of this, are things like racial slurs, jokes, scapegoating, us versus them, the other mentality. And I always point out to students that if we remove those are the things that most of us, my students included, are going to come into contact with. If those things do not have a place, that genocide will never take place. Students need to learn how to stand up for somebody else, not to be a bystander. The Holocaust affords lessons on empathy. The reality is that we're all the other. We're all the other to another group. And if we begin to recognize that, I have seen for myself where students begin to be able to identify with other groups. That's really the lessons that the Holocaust needs to teach, big picture.
Heidi, thank you so much for calling in. Heidi Omler is a social studies teacher at Ellsworth High School. We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Lee Auto Malls, with a goal of donating 30,000 meals to the Good Shepherd Food Bank this November. Learn more at leeauto.com. Starfire Storage, offering transportation, handling, and storage of fine art collections. Details at starfire.me. And Ocean View at Falmouth, with a goal of promoting optimal health through active retirement living. OceanviewRC.com.
American rock climber, environmentalist, and outdoor industry entrepreneur Yvonne Chouinard was born in Lewiston on November 9, 1938. Chouinard is most known for founding the clothing and gear company Patagonia. In 1970, on a trip to Scotland, he purchased some rugby shirts and sold them with great success. From this small start, the Patagonia company developed a wide selection of rugged technical clothing. In 2002, Yvonne Chouinard helped launch 1% for the Planet, and Patagonia became the first business to commit 1% of annual sales to the environment. Patagonia's headquarters is located in Ventura, California, where Chouinard encourages his employees to travel, surf, and work for environmental causes.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Thomaston Place Auction Galleries and the Maine Maritime Museum. Happy birthday, Maine!
I'm Tanya Mosley. The B-52s and REM put Athens, Georgia on the music map, but Pylon might have been everyone's favorite band there. A new box set documents Pylon's influential music. We'll have their story and the latest election news next time on Here and Now.
That's coming up in just a few minutes at noon, right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on our program, Holocaust Awareness, what people understand and don't about this time in history. Joining me, Shanna Bellows with the Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine and Abe Peck with the University of Southern Maine. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Shanna, we heard from a teacher who obviously is incredibly thoughtful about how she teaches Holocaust and human rights. What kind of help is there out there for other teachers in Maine?
Thank you so much. It was wonderful to hear Heidi, and she's someone we have a great relationship with, and the HHRC absolutely supports mandatory Holocaust education and the bill that those students brought. Just so important. Since 1984, the Holocaust and Human Rights Center has been offering teacher workshops every summer to train teachers in strategies and some of the resources to teach about the Holocaust. We partner with a group out of Boston called Facing History in Ourselves. And this summer, we held two workshops for teachers who were interested in teaching about the Holocaust. We had one seminar called Holocaust and Human Behavior, and another where we are encouraging English language arts teachers to teach Night by Elie Wiesel. So we did a seminar about teaching Night. And we are a resource. So the Michael Clara Center on the campus of the University of Maine at Augusta is a Holocaust museum. We have artifacts, archival materials, testimonials of the survivors who came to Maine. The books, like Edith's book, is on sale at the Holocaust Center, as is a memoir by Cantor Kurt Messerschmidt, who was very much beloved in the greater Portland area, and Judy Isaacson from Lewiston. So we have these resources. We have a library of over, we actually have 1,332 Holocaust-specific titles that are available for loan to teachers. So we have a team of four educators who are available, and all of these resources are free to support in any way possible any teacher across the state who wants to teach about the Holocaust, because we think it is so important, and that's really our mission.
We're going to go to Barbara Merson now, who's director of the Maine Jewish Film Festival. Barbara, thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for presenting this really important program.
Tell us what the dates are this year of the festival.
So we have just started our first virtual festival, which goes it goes from November 7th through the 22nd. And I would like to make the point that films are an excellent tool for Holocaust education. So we have a couple in our current roster that deal with the Holocaust in different ways. And just in general, we feel that films are a way that you can really have people who weren't there feel like they experience and hopefully understand and translate the lessons into their own personal lives.
Do you feel as though people in Maine have much understanding of Jewish culture and history?
I don't know how much personal understanding they have, but I do find that people in Maine are very open to learning about it.
Mm. I was just going to ask you to tell us where we can find more information about the film festival.
Sure. What I was going to say is that we've done surveys of our audience, and over 50% of our audience is generally does not identify as Jewish, which to me says that there's a lot of openness to learning about this.
Mm.
If people want more information, our website is www.mjff.org. And I would also say to all of, if there are educators listening to this program, we are definitely a resource like the Holocaust and Human Rights Center, with whom we often work. We would be happy to work with educators and, you know, give suggestions for films, help them obtain the films. In our current virtual world, actually, films it's very possible to show films online. So it's a good way to do this kind of education.
Well, Barbara, thank you so much for calling in. Barbara Merson is the director of the Maine Jewish Film Festival, which is virtual this year and started on Saturday. Thank you so much for calling in. I want to go to an email from Ryan. He writes, I was unfamiliar with the story of the Night of Broken Glass, so I guess I need to understand more about the overall history. Could you name five or so books that would serve as a good history of the entire Holocaust history? Abe, I'll ask you for a couple, and Shenna, you a couple.
Well, you know, I think that there are a whole group of books that are important. You know, the problem, of course, is that many of them are academic and lots of footnotes. But if you get past that, I think the most important book in many ways is a book by the historian Raoul Hilberg called The Destruction of European Jewry. And it really is a classic, one that I think makes the Holocaust come alive and shows the involvement of quote-unquote ordinary Germans in the killing process, in the process of destroying European Jewry. You know, and there are a number of books now that have come out that deal with the question, why the Germans? There's a book by a man named Peter Reichel called Germans into Nazis, which talks about the way in which ordinary Germans were seduced in many cases, but also in other cases had been yearning for some kind if you call it strong man, to come and relieve the terrible issues that affected Germany from the period after World War I till the Nazis took over in 1933. So that, I think, book is very important. But there are a whole group of other books, obviously, that I think maybe Shanna will enlighten us, because they have over 1,300 books that are on loan.
Shanna, of those 13...
It costs as much money.
Shanna, out of those 1,300, where would somebody... Where would Ryan, our emailer, start?
So definitely check out our website, hhrcmaine.org, and you can access our titles there. We are actually in a project right now with UMA to bring our library into the IRSA system so that it can be made available statewide through interlibrary loan, which I think is going to be really important. But and one of the reasons we do teacher education around teaching Elie Wiesel's Night is because if you're going to read one book about the Holocaust, that is a very powerful one to read. And we believe very much in the power of personal testimonials. You know, Heidi mentioned that at Ellsworth, she teaches through those testimonials of Holocaust survivors. There's one book I didn't mention, Etta Robel. She was part of the Jewish resistance and directly confronting the Nazis. Her memoir is incredibly powerful. Her daughter lives in Maine today. You know, Sonja and Kurt Messerschmidt's book, Death and Love in the Holocaust, tells the story of a couple that, like Abe's parents, you know, survived. And that's really remarkable. And Judy Isaacson's daughter story is about a mother-daughter relationship. They both survived together the camps. And so I think those personal stories really make it very real. When I read Edith's book, Against All Odds, that first chapter that talks about her experiences as a 12-year-old during the Night of Broken Glass, it's unforgettable. And I think that's so important for all of us.
We'll go to Arthur, who's calling from Peaks Island. Hi, Arthur. Go ahead.
Hi. You know, I spent a week in Auschwitz, and I came away with one really inspiring story that I want to share quickly and maybe a second. On the last day that we were there, I was there with a small group. We met three fellows from Armenia. They were probably in their early 20s, and they asked us our story, and we told them what brought us to Auschwitz. And we asked them, and here's what they said. They said, we grew up in Armenia, and we never heard about the Holocaust. And when we did, the stories sounded so incredible, they were hard to believe. So they told us, this is our vacation week. We came all the way to Auschwitz to find out what really happened. And when I heard that, I asked myself, how many people go to that much trouble to find out what really happened? Then, years later, I was giving a talk about this trip to a high school in New York. And I always begin by asking the students to share, what do you know about the Holocaust and what questions do you have? And for most of the students, it was more questions than knowledge. But one boy, and this was, I think he was in 11th grade, said, when I was quite young, really too young, he said, my grandmother insisted on taking me to one of the camps. And he said, I was too young to understand, but what I did understand was how important it was for her to show me the camp where she was held in person. And I just come away with the sense that the Holocaust is not just a fact of history. It's a personal story that we need to understand and take in and see the ways in which it might be coming to the fore again. It may not just be relegated to history.
Arthur, thank you. And Shanna, that is the whole point of the Holocaust and Human Rights Center, correct?
It is. So we're closed right now during the pandemic, but we hope to be open again this summer. We often host school groups during the year, and our educators are doing virtual presentations about the Holocaust this school year, but also do live presentations. And we have artifacts. You know, when Edith was talking about the fact that she was 12 years old, we have a teddy bear at the center. And it's an incredible story about a young girl. She was sent away
to boarding school under a pseudonym, and she was desperately homesick. So she went home to visit her parents at Easter, and she was, her parents and she were arrested and sent to Auschwitz. The teddy bear she had left on her bed at school, and she survived Auschwitz. Her two parents did not. They were murdered. But afterwards, she was reunited with her brother and with friends who had kept her bear for the entirety of the war. She came to Maine. She fell in love. She raised a daughter. She had a happy life. But when we show those kids that teddy bear and we tell them that story, it makes it more visceral and more real. And so that's what we have at the Michael Klahr Center. And I think we're a little bit of a hidden gem. I don't think people realize that Maine has a Holocaust Museum. And it's definitely, it's free and open to the public. So post-pandemic, we really encourage people to check it out. And in the meantime, check out hhrcmaine.org. Follow us on Facebook to start to learn some of that history and those connections here in Maine.
All right. Thank you, Arthur. Dave on Facebook, it was reported that Dwight David Eisenhower, upon seeing his first concentration camp in person, ordered every cameraman and journalist in the European theater to go to as many concentration camps as possible and document the horrors within the barbed wire fences. His comment to his adjutant was, "Get as much evidence as possible. I want to make sure that 50 years from now, when some SOB says it never happened, we can prove him wrong." Sadly, it was a good thing he did it. Abe, you have 30 seconds to respond.
I'll never make it. Well, I think that's correct. But I must tell you that in my case, there were others who had followed General Eisenhower's demand who were in close proximity, for instance, to a camp like Buchenwald. These were African-American men who were in a segregated army at that time, but who were cooks in the army, but who had gone there. And when my father came to America, we moved into an African-American neighborhood. And as Edith said, very few people believed what the survivors were telling them. It was just like science fiction. But these men had seen what had gone on. They'd seen the bodies stacked like cordwood. And in a sense, they were the ones, the only ones, who my father could take comfort in saying, "I believe you. I was there. I saw it."
Bearing witness. Well, thank you both for joining us today. The voice you just heard, Abraham Peck, adjunct professor of history at USM, a child of Holocaust survivors, and also State Senator Shana Bellows, executive director of the Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine. Today's sound engineer was Nikki Shields. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.